Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we've been studying the last 2 weeks, sutta number 148, the Chakka Sutta. This is called the Six Sets of Six. And the sutta revolves around the analysis of six sets of six items. That is, the six internal sense bases, in other words, the six sense faculties, the five physical sense faculties, and the mind faculty. There are six corresponding sense objects. These are called the six external bases. The six corresponding types of consciousness, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body consciousness, and inner consciousness or mental consciousness. The six types of contact. What is contact? The coming together of consciousness with its object through the sense faculty. Through contact, when contact takes place, there arises feeling. And so then we get the six classes or six types of feelings. Feeling that arises from eye consciousness, feeling that arises from ear consciousness, and so feeling from each of the other types of sensory consciousness. And then, on account of feeling, there arises craving. Craving is desire, blind desire, thirst, longing for the sense object that has arisen through the sense base and that has caused or given rise to that feeling. Usually we have the craving for the objects that give rise to pleasant feeling. Okay, then after the Buddha has shown how these six sets of six come into being, in the second major section of the sutta, he demonstrates how all of these items, six sets of six, 36 items, are non-self, not to be taken as self. And the reason why they are not to be taken as oneself, not to be identified with, is because all of them are subject to arising and passing away. And the idea of the self, this is an Indian, the Indian way of thinking, is the self has to be something which continues to exist. Not only in Indian thinking, but in our own way of natural or normal way of thinking. When we think, this is myself, what I really am, we think of something which is constantly existing, continuously existing. And if something arises and passes away, then it doesn't have that quality or characteristic of continuity or constancy, of lasting existence, substantial existence. And according to the Buddha's teaching, when we observe any object closely, as we observe it, the more closely we observe it, we see that it is arising and falling away at shorter and shorter intervals, more and more rapidly. And so even that which we think of as the consciousness, that which is doing the observation, even the consciousness itself, when we bend our awareness back to observe the consciousness, then we see that one moment of consciousness has arisen and passed away to give rise to be followed by the next moment of consciousness. And then that arises and passes away. And since each moment of consciousness or each occasion of consciousness arises and passes away, even consciousness cannot be our true self, our true identity. And so for this reason, all of these factors of experience, factors of cognition, are non-self, not the self. The six sense faculties, the six sense objects, the six types of consciousness, six types of contact, six types of feelings, and the six types of craving, all of them are non-self. Okay, this is pretty much a summary of what we've covered so far. Okay, now we come to a new section, sort of a new section in the sutta. Now we're at paragraph 16 on page 1133. Now the Buddha says he's going to speak about the way leading to the origination of, here we come to a very difficult word to translate. I use the original Pali word, sakkaya. Yeah, even the Chinese translators of the sutta, sometimes they didn't even translate it, but they just transliterated it into sajaya, which is a way of escaping from the difficulty. But other translators translate it as shun, right? Shun, body, which is somewhat misleading if one just takes it to refer to the physical body. Venerable Nyanamoli, in his original translation of Majjhima Nikaya, he had translated it as embodiment, which I thought was not so good. Embodiment, because embodiment, usually it suggests what? Like a soul that's embodied. I think even now we use embodiment more in a... Maywanti. Yeah, so embodiment now I think we use more in a metaphorical sense, like he's the embodiment of wisdom. She's the embodiment of good manners, something like that. So then in the first edition of the middle-length discourses, and I had changed Venerable Nyanamoli's original rendering to personality, because that was a rendering that I think Venerable Nyanamoli had used earlier, or some translators had used it earlier. But the word personality suggests something like a person's character. He has a very outward-going personality. This one has a melancholy personality. That's not what's meant at all. And following somebody else's suggestion, Venerable Thanissaro, I used identity for the second edition of the Majjhima Nikaya, which, again, it's any rendering, it's imperfect. Okay, but what is meant, we have to understand what is meant by this word Sakkaya. First, how it's derived. It's derived from the part kaya means body, and then the part sat means existing. So sakkaya means literally existing body, which is not all that helpful. But what is actually meant by sakkaya, what it refers to, is the compound or the combination of the, let's say, the integrated compound of the five aggregates. That is, the five aggregates taken not separately and distinctly, but the five aggregates taken as a composite whole, an integrally functional whole. The five aggregates taken as an integrally functional whole. Okay, and what are the five aggregates? It's actually the five aggregates of clinging, the five aggregates that are acquired through clinging. Okay, so what are these five aggregates? My memory is a little rusty today. I have to get them in the exact order. Okay, good. Okay, so these five aggregates, this is when we refer to a person, what does a person consist of? These five aggregates. And how do these five aggregates come into being? The five aggregates come into being starting from the moment of conception. The whole course of embryonic development is the development of the five aggregates. Birth is the emerging into the world of these five aggregates. And our whole life is this interplay of the five aggregates. We have form or bodily form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and then consciousness. Actually, we could say that the physical, of course, the foundation for our being in the world is the body, and that the body is what gives us physical presence in the world. And then through the body, consciousness interacts with the world that's present, that's made present through the body. And then as consciousness interacts with the world through the body, I mean, that interaction, you could say, is contact. And then from that contact, there arise the other three aggregates, feeling, perception, volitions, volitional formations. And we have a teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Where in the Four Noble Truths do we place Sakkaya? Somebody who's been coming for lectures for a long time, where do we put Sakkaya? Okay. What is Sakkaya? Put it more simply. No, you had it. The five aggregates, simply. Or five aggregates subject to clinging. Panchupadana kanda. The five aggregates bound up with clinging. Where in the Four Noble Truths do the five aggregates bound up with clinging belong? Right. It's the noble truth of suffering. Right. So, Sakkaya belongs in the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. To understand this is right view. Excuse me? No, don't confuse them. Okay, now what is it that brings this Sakkaya into being from one life to the next? Like, this is the fundamental cause of rebirth. Okay, one way to express it. Say it. Okay, tanha, let's put it in English.
Craving.
Okay, craving. One way to say that the cause or origin for this identity, for our person, let's say for our personal existence, is craving. Normally we think first we exist, then we have craving. And that's true also, but the opposite is also true. It's because we have craving that we exist in this world. That it's the craving that brings us into this world. And now another way to find what is the cause, the origin, what is it that constantly brings us back into this world, is being explained in this sutta. Here the text says, one regards the I thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. One regards forms, one regards eye consciousness, one regards eye contact, one regards feeling, one regards craving, thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. So it's when one thinks of anything that exists within this body and mind and perceptual process as being mine, as being what I am, as being myself. This way of regarding these things, this way of thinking, this way of conceiving these things, this is a decisive cause that brings us back again and again into this round or cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death. We usually don't think of such thoughts as having that kind of power. But this is the power within that kind of deluded thinking. It's the power to create again and again the cycle of existence. And what lies behind these three deluded thoughts? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. The Pali commentator calls them the three obsessions, the three gaha. Yeah, this Pali word gaha, if you turn it into the Sanskrit form graha, you could see that it's related etymologically to the English word grip. It comes from the same Indo-Aryan, Indo-European root gra. Grip, graha. Grasp, same root. And so this way of thinking, mine, that's mine. This body is mine. The thoughts are mine. That holding comes from craving. Then thinking, I am this, or just the thought, I am, is said to be a kind of manifestation of conceit, pride, building up pride on the basis of the various things with which one identifies. And then formulating the thought, this is myself. In this case, one is formulating some kind of philosophical position or a philosophical view revolving around the idea of what I truly am, what is my real essence, my real nature. That's forming the view of a self. Okay, and so these underlying forces of craving, conceit, and wrong views, those three forces are what continually drive this round of existence and keep it moving from life to life. And then the same kind of pattern goes on in regard to all of the other factors. So in paragraph 17 to 21, one just follows it through all the ways with regard to the ear, nose, tongue, body, the mind, mind objects, mind consciousness. With regard to all of these factors of existence, the three obsessions are ready to grasp onto them by way of these conceptions or thoughts, mine, I am, this is myself. And so the commentary says that what we have here is actually the first two noble truths shown in a somewhat indirect way. Instead of saying the truth of suffering and the truth of the origin of suffering, the Buddha speaks about identity, sakkaya, and the way leading to the origin of identity. And now in paragraph 22, he's going to show the way leading to the cessation of identity. This is the cessation of sakkaya, the disbanding of these five aggregates. This is, put it more positively, the way leading to liberation. And so the way leading to liberation is by changing these false thoughts or deluded thoughts in order to understand or to see all of these factors the way they really are regarding the I forms, I consciousness, I contact, I feelings, craving, regarding them, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. And so one applies this to all the other factors, from the ear to the nose, tongue, body, mind, taking them all in, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. One could say that this is like the peak or the high point of the Noble Eightfold Path. The whole Noble Eightfold Path converges upon this contemplation of all the factors of existence by way of right view, right vision, right insight, as being not mine, not I, not myself. And what serves to support this, you call it this critique of this idea of mine, I, and myself, was the previous demonstration of not-self that we have in paragraphs 10 to 15. Is this getting dry? It's pretty tough, I think. I mean, sometimes there are nice similes and little stories in the suttas, but there's nothing like that here. I don't know how to make any nice stories or similes to illustrate this. Any questions on this?
I'm trying to understand these three obsessions in light of the ten fetters.
Yeah.
I was aware that part of the satipanna is not regarding the five aggregates as self.
Yeah.
That's corresponding with the view.
Yeah.
And I know this conceit, O-N-E-N.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't aware that conceit was also based in the five aggregates. I thought conceit was just more of a free-floating idea of I am. I'm not sure how I am, but I am. This is anything that conceit is also based in the five aggregates.
Okay, this is a good point. If I think I understand your, let's see if I understand your question correctly. Let me see if I could reformulate it. Maybe the question is, what is the relationship between conceit and the view of self? Because conceit seems to be based on the five aggregates. And the view of self is also based on the five aggregates. So how should conceit be distinguished from the view of self? Is that...
I guess that's the way to put it. Frequently I've seen it said that satipanna no longer regards the five aggregates as self.
Right.
And I've seen it specifically referenced as a view, but just stated in the general, then it seems, oh, you wouldn't regard the five aggregates as I am either. Yeah, I guess there's a distinction between conceit and
view. Yeah, the way I would understand this, okay, this is a pretty subtle point. Okay, the view of self relates to the five aggregates by generally specifically taking one or another of the aggregates and saying, this is the self. Or even one could take the aggregates together as a group and say, the aggregates and the totality are a self. And I mean, the view of self will arise in those who haven't even heard of the aggregates. It doesn't mean that one... Usually it's those who haven't heard of the five aggregates who have the view of the self. But people who speculate will think, what is myself? Then they will try to work out some idea of what is my true essence, my true identity, my true nature. And some will come up with the idea, I'm nothing but the body, just a material entity. So I am the body. Some will come up with the idea, I have a soul, a spirit, which is eternal and everlasting, which remains ever the same. Some will say it is the mind or consciousness, which is myself. And so they'll come up with some kind of definite idea of what is myself, what is my essential identity. And so the view of self takes the form of, let us say, forming a theoretical notion of what is one's true essence, a true identity. Okay, the conceit, what's called the conceit I am, let's say the coarser kind of conceit is feeling some kind of what we would call normally pride, which can be based on the five aggregates, but it doesn't involve grasping them and taking them to be oneself, but just kind of natural pride might arise of thinking, I'm beautiful. And so it's, in a way it's based on the body, and so this pride will arise, which is referring to the body, but it's not taking the body to be one's true essence, a true identity. Or somebody who is maybe very gifted with keen intelligence will then have some pride based on their intelligence, but it doesn't mean that they're grasping the mind and taking their mind to be the self. somebody who has, say, a powerful will and great skill in accomplishing things might develop a pride based upon that strength of will. But it doesn't mean that they're grasping their volitional formations and saying volition is the self. Okay, and then even at the subtlest level, there is what is called the conceit I am, which is just the spontaneous idea that arises that I exist, that there's some kind of I that exists. And this spontaneous idea of I exist doesn't get filled in with the content as is done when one formulates a view of self. But the idea I am just arises. And for that idea I am will arise even in a stream enterer, even in a non-returner. But they will know that the idea I am is a delusion. So they don't buy into it the way an ordinary person will. But an ordinary person will, when that idea, I am, arises, they buy into it and get deceived by it. And then they start trying to figure out, what is this I? I have to figure out, what is the I? There must be something that the I is referring to. Is it my body? Is it my mind? Is it my will? And then they start formulating a view of self. Yeah.
The consciousness being a conception or a birth?
Yeah, according to the Buddha's teaching, consciousness is actually what initiates conception. So there is a... But first let's get clear what is meant by consciousness. When I use the word consciousness, it doesn't mean that there is necessarily clear, distinct cognitions taking place. You see, ordinarily when we use the word consciousness, we think that it means what I call clear and distinct cognition. You know, knowing that one knows, knowing that one is aware. But at the very moment of, the reason why conception takes place is that consciousness has carried over from a previous life, and consciousness, which is the basic, we call it a stream of consciousness, has lodged itself, say in the case of a human existence, it's lodged itself within the mother's womb, and it's to function, it has to link up with a fertilized egg cell, and then that begins the process of the new life. And so there is consciousness even at the moment of conception, but it's not a clear and distinct awareness. It's just a very, very dim, subliminal kind of mind, state of mind, like analogous to a person in a deep dreamless sleep. Except a person in a deep dreamless sleep has still the higher potential for the higher cognitive functions. But here we have a one-celled, just an egg cell, a one-cell egg, just an egg cell. Which, I mean, there's no brain yet, so there's no real support for higher cognitive functions. But even that egg cell serves as a support for some kind of mental function, just as we say that there's some kind of consciousness even in things like amoeba or paramecia, one-celled animals, even they will have some kind of consciousness. Though it's a very kind of primitive type of consciousness. But then as the embryo starts to develop, and then as the brain starts to develop, then the brain will serve as the base for the consciousness to be capable of more complex mental functions, till in the later stages of embryonic development, I believe it's said that the fetus can hear even music and respond to the different types of voices. I believe this has been said. And so this is indicative of the presence of a higher level of consciousness there. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it has clear, distinct awareness of verbalized awareness. Of course, that won't take place until, what, a year or two after birth. And that's quite different from the ability to cognize and think, here I am. That's something that can only take place after a few years. Yeah.
This is a follow-up to another question. So you described the gross idea, the gross conceit, the subtle conceit. The question was, that subtle conceit, you're saying that's still based on five aggregates somehow? I was looking at this passage, it's saying, you know, for instance, the cessation, you still have to still tackle this idea of self with regard to the five aggregates. So that's even for that.
Yeah, that, okay, the question is that subtle kind of conceit even based on the five aggregates? The subtle kind of conceit is based on the five aggregates, but it doesn't grasp the five aggregates individually. Generally, it just arises based on the five aggregates as a whole. That's the way I understand it.
Then cultivating that insight into the five aggregates not being self still affects that.
Yes, cultivating the insight into the five aggregates as being not mine, not I, not myself, will cut away the support for that subtle conceit. Okay, I want to go on because I want to try to finish the sutta today, tonight. Okay, so here we have this contemplation of all of these factors of experience as being not mine, not I, not myself. And this is a different way of formulating the fourth noble truth. As I said, this is the peak or the pinnacle of the noble eightfold path. Here, this is an advanced stage of practice so that it's not even necessary to formulate the other eight factors, but it's just the highest stage of right view is formulated, and all of the other factors are implied. And when the fourth noble truth is expressed, then this implies the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. And so from paragraph 16 through 27, we have the Four Noble Truths stated in a somewhat different way from the usual way. Okay, now we're going to go over the same territory again, but now treating it from a different angle. Here we're going to treat it by way of the what's called the anusayas, the underlying tendencies and the abandoning of the underlying tendencies. Okay, we're in paragraph 28. Okay, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Okay. Consciousness comes together with forms through the eye. And so when consciousness encounters the forms, visible forms through the eye, that is contact. Then because of this contact, there arises a feeling. And how is this feeling experienced? It's felt as either pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. Okay, now we have these three types of feelings. And now these three types of feelings are correlated with three different tendencies, deep underlying tendencies of the mind. Here the key word is anusaya. The prefix anu means something like along with, and saya means lying. So these are things that are lying along with the mind. Certain tendencies that are always lying deep within the mind, that constantly accompany the mind. And when they are stimulated, then they come up actively and create turmoil and trouble within the mind. Okay, so when one is touched by a pleasant feeling, then the usual tendency is to delight in it, to enjoy it. And then one welcomes it. And then one holds to that pleasant feeling, one clings to it. And that shows that the underlying tendency to lust or to craving has been activated. This is called the raga anusaya. I think underlying tendency to lust, the word lust suggests too much exclusively sexual craving or sexual desire, which is not the case here, but it's any kind of craving. Okay, then the opposite takes place. Sometimes one is touched by painful feeling. Can be painful physical feeling, a feeling that hits one through the senses, or it can be some painful mental feeling. One hears some painful news. One has some disappointment, hears some disappointing news, for example. And then when that painful mental feeling, painful physical feeling, painful mental feeling occurs, then one is inclined to sorrow, to grieve and lament. And then if it's really very heavily disappointing, then some people get so carried away. This is the way people in South Asia, India, Sri Lanka, when they get emotionally distressed, they weep and they beat their breast. Oh, how miserable I am. Oh. And then they become distraught. They lose their mind. That's when one gets overwhelmed by such terrible, painful feeling. And this shows that the underlying tendency to aversion, this is called patika, lies within. Okay, those are the two obvious types of feelings. And normally our minds swing back and forth between pleasure and pain. But there's a subtle type of feeling which is also dangerous, though we're usually not aware of it. This is called neither painful nor pleasant feeling, sometimes simply called neutral feeling. Now, when one doesn't understand this feeling, doesn't understand its origin, its disappearance, its passing away, doesn't understand the enjoyment in it, that's its gratification, doesn't understand the danger in it, that it's impermanent, and doesn't understand the way out from it, the release from it, all of that not understanding means avijja, ignorance. So then the underlying tendency to ignorance is becoming active. And then the Buddha says, that one shall here and now make an end of suffering without abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, without abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, without extirpating the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, without abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, this is impossible. So, in other words, these three underlying tendencies, the underlying tendency to craving for pleasant feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion or dislike for painful feeling, and the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neutral feeling, these three underlying tendencies, we can say, are the cause of dukkha, of suffering. Did somebody say something? So what do we have here? Again? Say? So far, not yet four of them. We have cause and when you mention the cause and also the result. Yeah. So you have the cause, the three underlying tendencies are the cause of suffering, And since he says it's impossible to make an end of suffering, that means you have suffering, right? So you have suffering and the cause of suffering. And in 29 to 33, develop the same thing just regarding the other five senses. Okay, now paragraph 34, we start off in the same way, because even a person who's training on the Buddha's path still has the sense faculties. When we start training, it doesn't mean we make ourselves blind. Don't put out the ears, don't cut out the nose, don't stop eating so that we can't taste anything delicious. Don't just sit in the sensory deprivation tank so that we don't feel anything with the body. Don't go into a coma so we don't think any thoughts. So we still have the five, six senses. Depending on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there arises a feeling felt as pleasant or painful or neutral. Okay, when one is touched by a pleasant feeling, if one does not delight in it, welcome it and cling to it, then the underlying tendency to craving doesn't become activated. Okay, one has to train through practicing mindfulness and insight on the pleasant feeling. One doesn't let the mind become carried away by the pleasant feeling, but through mindfulness one restrains the senses, and through insight one understands the feeling as just a pleasant feeling that arises, persists, and passes away, impermanent. When one is touched by a painful feeling, if one doesn't get carried away by it, grieving, lamenting, and weeping, and so on, then the underlying tendency to aversion does not lie within one. I think one has to understand, that sort of bring out the meaning of this. Actually, when one is in training, one will train oneself not to sorrow, not to grieve, and so on, but still the underlying tendency will be within. But one has to train not to get carried away by these feelings while the tendency is still within, but through practicing mindfulness and insight, one is working to eliminate the underlying tendency. So at this point, one is not being carried away by the underlying tendency. And as one gains deeper in insight and wisdom, then one is removing the underlying tendencies. Okay, when one is touched by the neither painful nor pleasant feeling, if one understands it as it really is, its origin, its disappearance, its gratification, the danger, and the escape in regard to that feeling, okay, as one understands it in that way, then one is starting to eliminate the ignorance in regard to it. Okay, so these are the ways. First, one has to work in stages. First, one restrains the natural, immediate tendencies to react to pleasant feeling with attachment, to react to painful feeling with sorrow and with aversion, and to remain in ignorance about the nature of neutral feeling. Okay, and then from that standpoint of restraint, one contemplates and observes the nature of feeling. And as one contemplates and observes the real nature of feeling, then one penetrates more deeply into the true nature of feeling. And it's by seeing deeply into the nature of feeling that one starts to weaken these underlying tendencies, until when this insight reaches very deep, profound levels, that it cuts off the underlying tendencies. And then the Buddha says that one shall here and now make an end of suffering by abandoning the underlying tendency to lust or craving for pleasant feeling, by abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, by extirpating or pulling out the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge. That shows the key. Abandoning ignorance and arousing true wisdom, true knowledge. This is possible. And then this is repeated for all of the other senses. Okay, so here we have two noble truths. What two noble truths? How are they shown? Okay, so we could say that, yeah, by abandoning the underlying tendency to craving for pleasant feeling, by abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, by extirpating the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, this is the path. And then that's the fourth noble truth. And then the third noble truth, the extinction or cessation of suffering, is shown by this statement, one here and now makes an end of suffering. Okay, then paragraph 40 and 41. This, I've gone through the same sequence in other suttas. So this just shows, again, it's just another way of showing the sequence. When one sees all of this with right insight, one becomes disenchanted with all of these factors from the eye through the senses. Being disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. Now in paragraph 41, through dispassion, the mind is liberated. And when it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it's liberated. Then one understands. No one is finished with the round of rebirths. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And now, the ending, the last few sentences are quite important. Okay, this is what the Buddha said, the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And then while this discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, the minds of 60 monks were liberated from the taints. Yeah, that's something special ending, that because this discourse was very powerful. And so even while they were listening, 60 monks were liberated on the spot. And then the commentary says that not only the Buddha spoke this sutta, but Venerable Sariputta, Moggallana, and many other great disciples taught it, and each time they taught it, 60 monks achieved arhatship. Then in Sri Lanka, there was an elder named Maliyadeva who taught the sutta in 60 places, and each time he taught it, 60 monks attained arhatship. And then there was an elder named Chulanaga who taught the sutta in a vast assembly of humans and gods. And at the end of his discourse, 1,000 monks attained arhatship. He did surpass the Buddha. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
We need a pleasant, we need a painful but pleasant feeling. First, it says that if one doesn't understand that actually is the origination, disappearance, verification, nature, and escape, I'm assuming that also applies to pleasant and painful feelings. We had a previous sutta that
Yeah, there are suttas elsewhere which say that one is supposed to be able to understand each type of feeling by way of in these five ways, by way of origin, passing away, gratification, danger, and escape or release. But it's just that not knowing this is ignorance, and so ignorance is the special tendency that's connected to the neutral feeling.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the gratification of a neutral feeling.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. What is the gratification in regard to neutral feeling? You see, neutral feeling can be quite peaceful and pleasant. It's peaceful. It's not a pleasant feeling, but that peaceful feeling is kind of gratifying. There's a dull, peaceful feeling, like if one is lying back on a sofa with the feet up on a footrest. You know, it's the middle of the day, and one is just in a completely sort of floating state of mind. That's a neutral feeling, when it's neither especially blissful nor in any state of pain, but the mind is just kind of dull, not necessarily drowsy, but it's kind of dull, quiet state of mind, but one enjoys that. Okay, so that is the dull neutral state of mind. And there's a subtle attachment that can underlie that. And then there's a superior kind of neutral feeling that one becomes attached to. And that is the neutral feeling that can arise in the fourth jhana and in the formless meditative attainments. And then subtle attachments can arise in regard to that neutral feeling, even though it's a peaceful feeling, but one develops a subtle attachment to it. Yeah, the release, it's always said to be the release or the escape. Chanda, raga, pahana. It's always the abandoning or the giving up of the attachment and desire for it. Yeah, yeah. The giving up of desire and attachment. Any further questions? Okay, then next week we do the, is it called the Nandika Sutta? That's number 146, I think, correct? Right, that's Nandikovada Sutta. Okay, that's a very good one. Okay, so we end by sharing the merits. And I want to mention, anybody would like a copy of the Volume 2 CD, Middle Length Discourses CD. Copies are up here. Okay, we share the merits with the devas, buddhas, spirits, and other beings, asking them to rejoice in these merits, to protect the Buddha's teaching, protect the world, protect ourselves and others, and all other beings. Akasa ta chabuma ta Deva naga mahitika punyantang anumotiva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata Deva naga mahitika punyantang anumotiva chirang rakantu desanam Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mang param etavata cha amhehi sampadam punyasampadam Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhava gupadaya avici hetato etantare sata